Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in Exodus. We have our parasha today, the Kitisa, however you pronounce it. It's not really terribly, that's how you pronounce it in Hebrew. It's when you take a census. This is Exodus chapter 30, starting in verse 11. We're going through Exodus 34 through verse 35. And then we can talk about it. So, Exodus chapter 30, verse 11. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "When you take a census of the children of Israel, according to their number, every man shall give the Lord an atonement for his soul when counting them, so there will not be a plague among them when counting them. This they shall give, everyone who passes through the census, a half shekel of the sacred shekel. The shekel is 20 gerahs, half a shekel as a portion to the Lord. Everyone who passes through the census from 20 years of age and up shall give the portion of the Lord. The wealthy shall not increase, and the destitute shall not decrease from half a shekel, to give the portion of the Lord to atone for your souls. You shall take the silver of the atonements from the children of Israel and give it for the work of the tent of meeting. And it shall be a remembrance before the Lord for the children of Israel to atone for your souls." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "You shall make a copper laver, and its base of copper for washing. Place it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and put water there. From it, Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands together with their feet. Whenever they come to the tent of meeting, they shall wash with water and not die. Or when they approach the altar to serve, to raise up in smoke a fire offering to the Lord, they shall wash their hands and feet and not die. It shall be for them an eternal decree, for them and his offspring for their generations." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Now you take for yourself choice spices, 500 shekel weights of pure myrrh, fragrant cinnamon, half of which shall be 250 shekels, 250 of the fragrant cane, and 500 of cassia in the sacred shekel weight, and a hin of olive oil. Of it you shall make oil of sacred atonement, a blended compound, the handiwork of a perfumer. It shall remain oil of sacred atonement. With it you shall anoint the tent of meeting and the ark of the testimonial tablets, the table and all its utensils, the menorah and its utensils, the incense altar and the burnt offering altar and its utensils, and a laver in its base. You shall sanctify them, and they shall remain holy of holies. Whatever touches them shall become holy. You shall anoint Aaron and his sons and sanctify them to minister to me. You shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, 'This shall remain for me oil of sacred anointment for your generations. It shall not be smeared on human flesh. You shall not duplicate it in its formulation. It is holy. It shall remain holy for you. Anyone who shall compound its like or who shall put it upon the alien shall be cut off from his people.' The Lord said to Moses, 'Take yourselves spices, stacte, onycha, and galbanum, spices and pure frankincense. These should be of equal weight. You shall make it into a spice compound, the handiwork of a perfumer, thoroughly mixed, pure, and holy. You shall grind some of it finely and place some of it before the testimonial tablets in the tent of meeting, where I shall designate a time to meet you. It shall remain holy of holies to you. The incense that you make in its portion you shall not make for yourselves. It shall remain holy to you for the Lord. Whoever makes it like to smell it, that shall be cut off from his people." Chapter 31. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "See, I have called by name Bezaleel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. I have filled him with godly spirit and wisdom, insight and knowledge, and with every craft to weave designs, to work with gold, silver, and copper, cutting stone for setting, and wood carving, to perform every craft. And behold, I have assigned with him Eliab, son of Ahishmach, of the tribe of Dan. And I have endowed the heart of every wise-hearted person with wisdom. They shall make all that I have commanded you, the tent of meeting, the ark of the testimonial tablets, and the cover that is upon it, all utensils of the tent, the table and its utensils, the pure menorah and all its utensils, and the incense altar, the burnt offering altar and all its utensils, the levar and its base, the knit vestments, the sacred vestments of Aaron the Kohen, and the vestments of his sons to minister, the anointment oil and the incense spices of the sanctuary, like everything that I have commanded you, they shall they make. The Lord said to Moses, saying, Now you speak to the children of Israel, saying, However, you must observe my Sabbaths, for it is a sign between me and you for your generations to know that I am the Lord who makes you holy. You shall observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Its desecrators shall be put to death. For whoever does work on it, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days work will be done. On the seventh day is a day of complete rest. It is sacred to the Lord. Whoever does work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. The children of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to make the Sabbath an eternal covenant for the generations. Between me and the children of Israel is a sign forever that in a 6 day period, the Lord made the heaven and earth. And the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. When he finished speaking to them on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of testimony, the stone tablets inscribed by the finger of God. Chapter 32. Now the people saw Moses had delayed in descending the mountain. And the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, Raise up, make for us gods that will go before us. For this man Moses, who has brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what it become of him. Aaron said to them, Remove the rings of gold that are in your ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me. The entire people removed the gold rings that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He took it from their hands and bound it up in a cloth and fashioned it into a molten calf. And they said, This is your God, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. Aaron saw and built an altar before it. Aaron called out and said, A festival to the Lord is tomorrow. They rose early the next day and offered up burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. The people sat to eat and drink, and they got up to revel. The Lord spoke to Moses, Go, descend. For your people that you have brought up from the land of Egypt has become corrupt. They have strayed quickly from the way that I have commanded them. They have made themselves a molten calf, prostrated themselves to it, and sacrificed to it. And they said, This is your God, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. The Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. And now desist from me. Let my anger flare up against them, and I shall annihilate them, and I shall make you a great nation. Moses pleaded before the Lord his God and said, Why, Lord, should your anger flare up against your people, whom you have taken out from the land of Egypt, with great power and a strong hand? Why should Egypt say the following, With evil intent did he take them out, to kill them in the mountains, and to annihilate them from the face of the earth? Relent from your flaring anger, and reconsider regarding the evil against your people. Remember, for the sake of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself, and you told them, I shall increase your offspring the stars of heaven, and its entire land of which I spoke, I shall give to your offspring, and it shall be their heritage forever. The Lord reconsidered regarding the evil that he declared he would do to his people. Moses turned and descended from the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, the tablets inscribed on both their sides. They were inscribed on one side and the other. The tablets were God's handiwork, and the script was the script of God, engraved on the tablets. Joshua heard the sound of the people in its shouting. He said to Moses, The sound of battle is in the camp. He said, Not a sound of shouting of strength, nor a sound of shouting weakness. A sound of distress do I hear. It happened as he drew near the camp and saw the calf and the dances that Moses' anger flared up. He threw down the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made and burned it in the fire. He ground it to a fine powder and sprinkled it over the water. He made the children of Israel drink it. Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you brought so grievous sin upon it?" Aaron said, "Let not my master's anger flare up. You know the people is disposed toward evil. They said to me, 'Make us a god that will go before us.' For this man Moses, who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So I said to them, "Who has gold?" They removed it and they gave it to me. I threw it in the fire and this calf popped out. Moses saw the people that it was exposed. For Aaron had exposed them to disgrace them among those who rise up against them. Moses stood at the gateway of the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, join me." All the Levites gathered around him. He said to them, "So says the Lord God of Israel, every man put his sword on his thigh and pass back forth from the gate to gate in the camp. Let every man kill his brother, every man his fellow, every man his near one." The Levites did as Moses said, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Moses said, "Dedicate yourselves this day to the Lord, for each has opposed his son and his brother, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day." On the next day, Moses told the people, "You have committed a grievous sin. Now I shall ascend to the Lord. Perhaps I can win atonement in the face of your sin." Moses returned to the Lord and said, "I implore, this people has committed a grievous sin and made themselves a god of gold. And now, if you would but forgive their sin, but if not, erase me now from your book that you have written." The Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I shall erase him from my book. Now go, lead the people to where I have told you. Behold, my anger shall go before you, and on that day that I make my account, I shall bring their sin to account against them." And the Lord struck the people with a plague because they had made the calf that, because the calf that Aaron had made. Chapter 33. The Lord said to Moses, "Go, ascend from here, you and the people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt, to the land about which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, saying, 'I shall give it to your offspring.' I shall send an angel ahead of you, and I shall drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, to a land that flows with milk and honey, because I shall not ascend among you, for you are a stiff-necked people, lest I annihilate you on the way." The people heard this bad tiding, and they became grief-stricken, and no one donned his jewelry. The Lord said to Moses, "Say to the children of Israel, 'You are a stiff-necked people. If I ascend among you, I may annihilate you in an instant. And now, remove your jewelry for yourself, and I shall know what I shall do.'" So the children of Israel were stripped of their jewelry from the Mount Horeb. Moses would take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, as far from the camp, and called it the tent of meeting. So it was that whoever sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. Whenever Moses would go out to the tent, the entire people would stand up and remain standing, every one at the entrance of his own tent, and they would gaze after Moses until he arrived at the tent. When Moses would arrive at the tent, a pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and he would speak with Moses. The entire people would see the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, and the entire people would rise and prostrate themselves, everyone at the entrance of his tent. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as a man would speak with his fellow. Then he would return to the camp. His servant Joshua, son of Nun, a lad, would not depart from within the tent. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, 'Take this people onward,' but you did not inform me whom you will send with me. And you said, 'I shall know you by name,' and you have also found favor in my eyes. And now, if I indeed found favor in your eyes, make your way known to me, so that I may know you, so that I may find favor in your eyes, and see that this nation is your people." He said, "My presence will go and provide you rest." So he said to him, "If your presence does not go along, do not bring us forward from here. How then will it be known that I have found favor in your eyes, I and your people, unless you accompany us? And I and your people will be made distinct from every other people on the face of the earth." The Lord said to Moses, "Even this thing which you spoke, I shall do. For you have found favor in my eyes, and I have known you by name. He said, show me now your glory. He said, I shall make all my goodness pass before you, and I shall cast out with the name of the Lord before you. I shall show you favor when I choose to show favor, and I shall show mercy when I choose to show mercy. And he said, you will not be able to see my face, for no human can see me and live, said the Lord. Behold, there is a place near me you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I shall place you in the cleft of the rock. I shall shield you with my hand until I have passed. Then I shall remove my hand and you will see my back. My face may not be seen. Chapter 34. The Lord said to Moses, carve out yourself two stone tablets like the first ones, and I shall inscribe on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you shattered. Be prepared in the morning. Ascend the Mount Sinai in the morning and stand by me there on the mountaintop. No man may ascend with you, nor may anyone be seen on the entire mountain. Even the flock and the cattle may not graze facing that mountain. So he carved out two stone tablets like the first ones. Moses arose early in the morning and ascended to Mount Sinai, as the Lord had commanded him. He took two stone tablets in his hand. The Lord descended in a cloud and stood with him there. He called out with the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, the God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abundant in kindness and truth, preserver of kindness for thousands of generations, forgiver of iniquity, willful sin, and error, and who cleanses but does not cleanse completely, recalling the iniquity of the parents upon the children and grandchildren of the third and fourth generations. Moses hastened to bow his head toward the ground and prostrate himself. He said, if I now have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, let my Lord go among us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and you shall forgive our iniquity and error and make us your heritage. He said, behold, I seal a covenant. Before your entire people I shall make distinctions, such as never been created in the entire world among all the nations. And the entire people among whom you are will see the work of the Lord, which is awesome, that I am about to do with you. Beware of what I command you today. Behold, I drive out before you the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Be vigilant, lest you seal a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you come, lest it be a snare among you. Rather, you shall break apart their altars and smash their pillars, cut down their sacred trees. But you shall not prostrate yourselves to an alien god. For the very name of the Lord is Jealous One. He is a jealous God. Lest you seal a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they will stray after their gods and slaughter their gods, and he will invite you, and you will eat from his slaughter. You will take their daughters for your sons, and their daughters will stray after their gods, and you entice your sons to stray after their gods. You should not make for yourselves molten gods. You shall observe the festival of Matzot. For a 7-day period you shall eat Matzot, as I commanded you, at the appointed time in the month of spring. For the month of spring you went forth from Egypt. Every first issue of a womb is mine, as well as any of your livestock that produces a male. The first issue of an ox or a sheep, the first issue of a donkey, you shall redeem with a lamb or a kid. If you do not redeem it, you shall axe the back of its neck. You shall redeem every firstborn of your sons. They shall not appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you work, on the seventh day you shall desist. You shall desist from plowing, from harvesting. You shall make a festival of weeks with the first offering of the wheat harvest, and the festival of harvest shall be at the changing of the year. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord, the God of Israel. For I shall banish nations before you and broaden your boundary. No man will covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God 3 times a year. You shall not slaughter my blood offering while in the possession of leavened food, nor may the feast offering of the Pesach festival be left overnight until morning. The first of your land's early produce you shall bring to the temple of the Lord your God. Do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Lord said to Moses, write these words for yourself, for according to these words have I sealed the covenant with you and Israel. He remained there with the Lord for 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread, and he did not drink water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. When Moses descended from the Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in the hand of Moses, he descended from the mountain. Moses did not know the skin of his face had become radiant when he had spoken to him. Aaron and all the children of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face become radiant, and they feared to come near him. Moses called to them, and Aaron and the elder leaders of the assembly returned to him, and Moses would speak to them. After that, all the children of Israel would approach. He would command them regarding everything the Lord had spoken to him on Mount Sinai. Moses finished speaking with them and placed a mask on his face. When Moses would come before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the mask and tell his departure when he would leave and tell the children of Israel whatever he had been commanded. When the children of Israel saw Moses' face, that Moses' face had become radiant, Moses put the mask back on his face until he came to speak with him. A lot of reading. Yes, questions?
Did he glow forever or just for a little while?
It's not clear how long he glowed. It doesn't specify how long he was glowing. All it specifies is that, and he would cover his face up when he had come from the mount, from the seeing God, he was glowing for some period of time. It could have been his whole life. It could have been for a few hours. It doesn't specify. I would speculate it was not for his whole life continuously. And I say that because, I won't go there yet because he hasn't remarried yet. But there's other issues that happen later on. He probably didn't glow his whole life, but there's some period of time which he was glowing. We don't know for how long. Yes. List of questions. Go ahead. I got time.
Okay, so the first thing is in chapter 30, 31 through 36.
Chapter 30, verse 31 through 36. Okay, that records.
Talking about the
oil of anointment.
The oils.
Yes, the oils.
My experience with humanity is you tell them not to do something, that's exactly
and they
what they're going
do
to
it.
Do. So.
You've been around a while.
Well, unfortunately, I happen to deal with a lot of pagans in my job. So, you know, I have to basically hold my breath when I'm around a smell. And I wonder if that smell is that, actually.
I wouldn't have the foggiest idea.
It's consistent every time I... Anyway, that's beside the point.
That's possible. Frankincense is pungent. It's designed to get through whatever it is quickly.
I know what frankincense is.
Yeah. And I've smelt each one of these spices individually because they're easily purchased. I should say easily purchased. The definition of these words are a little bit sketchy, so no one knows precisely which words what, but these ones, I don't mix them. But each one of them are just, they're used for different medicinal reasons. They have their function.
Well, I deliver to places that are witchcraft.
Yeah, and so, I don't know much about witchcraft. So.
Obviously.
Not my expertise.
My experience is that if you tell somebody not to do something, they're going to do it, regardless. Right. The other thing is, verse 14...
Of chapter...
I have to figure out what...
Oh.
Actually, it's about the Shabbat.
Oh, the
that's about any work of it. There.
Yes.
You ask somebody, anybody, that follows Torah about what exactly work is, and there's so many different definitions.
Lots of definitions, right.
Okay. But Yahusha goes, he's on the Shabbat, and he heals this guy, and he tells him to take up his mat and walk.
Right.
By rabbinical law, that's working.
Right. What does that mean?
I'm like at a loss. What does Yahusha mean? I mean, I don't care what the rabbis say, but what does Yahusha
What is he talking
want?
About? What's he talking
what
about?
What does Yahusha want?
Yes.
To do?
What is he? What is his
because
criteria?
I'm tired of all the confusion.
I get
really
that. Is. I get that. I'll do my best. I'm not an expert. I'll do my best.
Next is several places there is talking about on the holy days we are to offer up a burnt offering. It doesn't tell us what to burn.
There's many places it talks about what to burn. And just different spots, and not all right here. There's some in Leviticus telling you what to burn, depending on what you're doing.
I can't find words telling me what to burn.
The burnt offering, yeah.
Because even the Feast of Tabernacles, no, the first one, seventh month, first day.
Yeah.
That one, we're supposed to offer a burnt offering, but we don't do it here.
So. Oh, no. Oh, we don't have a temple. I'm sorry, should be more. It's very relevant.
Well, the word says that we don't have to go somewhere.
Right, it doesn't.
We can do everything.
But there are very specific rules given on how to do and what to do and how you're doing it. And so if you do it the wrong way or the wrong place, you screwed up. And that's a bigger problem. There's a huge distinction between, let me get those words right, forgive me if I screw them up, I use it incorrectly. There's the Levitical priesthood laws, and then there are the rest of the laws in the Torah. They are not the same laws.
Oh, I know that.
So Levitical priesthood laws, there's a group of laws specifically for how a Levitical priest is supposed to do certain things at certain times, certain ways. That is a fixed set of laws. It does not apply to Joe Schmo, the Jew, from somewhere else. However,
the Levitical law is basically what was given to us when we blew up at the golden calf, when we transgressed. But that's another story.
And you can argue that. I think it's a little bit stretched to say that that was the moment in time which the Levitical law was given.
Well, it actually says right there that I was planning on killing you.
Right. And there's more. Yeah, there's other plans. And he does kill you. He does kill them all. God does kill them all off. Well, except a few. He does kill them all off. Two survive. We'll get into that a little bit. Not a lot, but we'll try to discuss that today.
One.
Go ahead.
Verse 20. Hold on, let me find out what.
Verse 20.
Find out which 20.
Well, it can't be a 32. It's only 18 verses.
Would have had it. Verse 32. Oh, sorry. Chapter 32.
Chapter 32, okay.
Verse 20.
Took the calf, and they made burnt... made and burned it in fire, and ground it in fine powder, and sprinkled it with water, and the people drank it.
My understanding of that is that there is another part where a husband accuses the wife of adultery.
Correct.
She has to drink some kind of substance. If that substance causes her to bloat, it will kill her, and she'll die, which is a guilty.
To designate guilt.
If happens, she's innocent, and therefore he has to stay married to her forever.
Which pretty much,
I
yes.
I honestly wouldn't want to stay married to a husband at that point, because if he can't trust me, then frankly I don't want to be in this marriage in the first place.
That's the point. That's recorded, that is instructed in a Book of Numbers, chapter 5. So, there's details of how to test the husband, test the wife.
I've read this, and then I trace it to the other, and I wonder if that's what was really going on. If everybody that was drinking this, that bloated, if they were the ones that actually transgressed.
We'll discuss that symbolically as well today. That's the plan. We'll discuss that as well. Lots of questions. Some of them I already have written down, ready to go, but some were new. Yes, go ahead.
My scripture.
Which verse?
It is 32:16, and my scripture says the tablets are sapphires that were inscripted upon.
32:16, tablets were the God's handiwork. Script was a script of God engraved on the tablets. What does yours read?
Mine says, and the sapphires were the work of Elohim, and their writing was the writing of Elohim, graven upon the sapphires. And when Yahusha heard, Aleph Tab, the noise of the people as they shouted. Okay, then it goes on.
This continues on the story. Because I have not researched the Hebrew word for sapphire versus the Hebrew word for tablet, I'm not sure why it's being translated as sapphire. If I had researched that, I could be able to answer to you, but I didn't look that up. If somebody else has a computer on, they can search it themselves. What is the Hebrew word for tablet versus the Hebrew word for sapphire? I do not know. So I have not looked them both up. I assume it's those tablets. He does, and keep in mind, it's done on purpose. The Hebrew words are used and defined many different ways, because there's different ways of pronouncing the word, spelled the same. In this case, the word engravement, for example, the engraved, to the ground tablets being engraved, and that the word engraved also means free.
Oh.
To be free. So it's the same word, different pronunciation, the same exact spelling. So different meaning, but it's done on purpose. It's not by accident. Hebrew reuses words to get you an idea of what's going on. So the engraved and free, we'll talk about that. They're supposed to be the same word. We'll talk about that later. Questions? Yes.
My question is, if Aaron knew not to make an idol,
Why did he make one anyway?
That's an excellent question. That's an excellent question. If Aaron knew not to make an idol, why did he make one anyway? Well, first of all, we don't know what Aaron didn't know. However, he probably knew not to make an idol. That's probably an obvious one. It's like, it's just out of control. Yeah, he did a very good job trying to point fingers away from himself. We'll discuss a little bit. Each group and belief system has their own beliefs of what Aaron didn't know and why. And unfortunately, this text doesn't give Aaron a good picture. He screwed up. Now, keep in mind, later on, he's supposed to become the high priest of all of Israel. So the screw up could not have been so severe that God dumped all the blame on Aaron. Because why would he then choose and convert Aaron to be the high priest? So it's a little bit of a question there as far as how much responsibility and culpability Aaron had at making this. It has been commonly believed that if Aaron did not make the calf, the people would have killed him and moved on to the next person. But I don't know. And they say that because they believe that Hur, this is tradition only, that Hur, the husband of Miriam, was killed at this event. That is, tradition says so. Miriam's husband. Yeah, Jewish tradition. Not in the scriptures. But if that is the case, then Aaron could theoretically fear for his own life. But no one knows. He has him. Go ahead.
just two quick questions. So I'm not really sure on the tent that Moses pitched.
Oh, right.
Is there a special significance? Was it, you know, I mean, it obviously wasn't the tabernacle or made from special linen.
Not yet. That hasn't been built yet.
Right. So if they're all living in tents, was this just an average, anyday tent that they set up out there? Was there anything about that
unique about it? There was some uniqueness to the tent. It is not Moses' personal living quarters tent. It is a tent designated to talk with or meet with God so God can communicate with Moses. It is not the tent of the temple tent, which has, you know, the Ark of the Covenant in it. That's not been built yet. It's a tent of meeting only. It's like the town hall, so to speak. It's literally, that's its function. So that's what he built there. What it looks like doesn't tell us right now. There are two tents being built. There's one, the town hall meeting, and then there's the temple tent that has all the decorative, colorful stuff in it that God has been describing to Moses for weeks now in his life on the mountaintop. These are two separate things. Okay. Moses goes in this tent of meeting and talks to God. Moses does not go in the holy tabernacle tent that's being built. That's Aaron's job to go in there. So there's two different places, two different functions. One, it's a communications, but it's like a prophet would go and have his own secluded place to talk to. God and Moses do this on purpose. So people can see Moses walking. He's alive. He goes in the tent. They see God come down. He comes back. As opposed to go get the mountain, it's up in clouds and don't see him for, you know, what, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, whatever it is. And you don't see anything happens. This is for them to actually see and physically watch what happens so they are not so easily swayed at things around them or their own ideas.
So just two other quick things. I when you go back towards the beginning of the reading, you know, there's the Levites, I guess, bring out their swords and kill 3,000.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really say whether they were sojourners or what tribes they were from.
Oh, who was killed? Right. It doesn't specify who was killed.
It doesn't really say. Was it just the closest 3,000? They got tired and quit. Is there anything to that?
They couldn't run fast enough.
Yeah. Just the fat guys got killed that day.
The weaklings. It does not specify which tribe the 3,000 came from. There are two beliefs. Beliefs only, not biblical text. Beliefs that one is that it's believed that some of the revelers were the riffraff that came out of Egypt with the Israelites. That they were somehow the mix of the Egyptians and everybody else who were afraid and saw this great powerful God that will follow it, though they have no physical or genealogical attachment to Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. They came along. That's one belief system. And the belief was that that's where the idea came from, that they fashioned this idea, we should make a god, and they riled everybody up to make a god. That is one belief. I can't say it's right or wrong. No one knows. The other is that it's just the ordinary people have been living in Egypt for a long time now, and everything is a physical god. Everything is. Whether it's the fish, whether it's the water, whether it's the crocodiles, whether it's the blood or the snakes, everything is a god. So unless you can physically see it and touch it and feel it, it isn't real. So there's that school of thought that if that's the case, then anybody can make us this thing so we can touch it or feel it and be part of it. Because right now it's only between Moses and this cloud. And we're not part of it. We're not part of this. We're excluded from it. We can't even touch the rock that the mountain he's on. Can't go too close. Our animals aren't even allowed to touch it. So it's all Moses and his God up there. And then there's the rest of us down here. What should we do? So there's those two different belief systems of how they're done. No proof for either one.
Okay. And then just one other thought, that was just coming off of what somebody else said about, you know, the divorce and the sour drink and
the
bloating and the,
yeah.
I think it even says something about
the
thighs being weak or
getting the jealousy test, right?
Yeah. Does that have, I mean, I've heard, and I don't know if you were going to talk about it or not, but I heard a parallel when they talk about Jesus at the cross and giving, you know, in fact, because, you know, God had given the northern tribes a certificate of divorce and divorced them, but that was also a role that Yeshua played on the cross by asking for that drink, knowing that he was going to get the bitter vinegar, which, you know, caused his stomach to bloat, as in he was pierced by the side, his legs gave out, which caused him to choke, which would do away with that certificate of divorce, allowing, after Yeshua, for him to gather his people back together through, you know, bringing the other, you know, because that divorce has been finalized
right.
through his death on the cross.
That is an interesting perspective. I had never thought of that. It's possible. As far as why specifically he asked for that drink and whether or not that drink has any association to this. I'd have to research that to find out. The test given for the adulterous wife, which is, as Cheryl pointed out, extremely similar to the test given here as people grinding up the calf, had to do with the dirt or the dust and the words spoken against the person. That's really what it was for. The adulterous wife, well, we can go there. It's Numbers chapter 5. I'll go there in a few minutes, not quite yet. But there's things that's part of this. There's an offering she has to give that she's holding in her hands. There is the dirt from the temple floor, as well as the priest has to write down a condemnation curse if for some reason she's been sleeping around or not. And he scrapes off the ink after he's written it into the drink, and she was to drink it all. And then if she's innocent, then nothing happens to her. But it tastes very good, but it's fine. It's just dirty water. And if she's guilty, then it will affect her. Some internal organs will fail to function. And a stomach bloating means, typically, a starvation effect happens. Their body stops functioning. So it's designed to destroy your body's ability to consume mineral content out of your food, which depending on what's in the water, it can do that. and that's what its intent was. But the dirt on the tabernacle floor is tied to the blood that is being offered from every sacrifice that goes over time, over and over and over again, as the years go by. It's intermixed amongst the dirt on the floor. So every sacrifice happened before her, she's part of. That's part of this test. Realistically, the test ever work? I have no clue. Was test ever done? I don't know. But as Cheryl pointed out, it's very similar to this test done here, which is probably why the test was written down, because it matches this test here. And grinding up the gold as dust on the feet, which is what essentially breaking an idol is going to be. You burn it, you smash it, and it turns into dust. Don't use the gold anymore. It's dirt. Well, that's essentially what Moses is doing. He's turning it into dirt, which is not, that's different than the test given to the adulterous wife. We'll discuss more of that similarities. There are a lot of them between the adulterous wife and this test. No, there's a few I brought a lot. How that it ties to the Messiah's drinking of the, I don't know. I've never researched that to find out. If somebody else has, you're welcome to voice up your opinions, but I do not know. That's one I have to look up and see if I can find out more information. There could be some interesting parallels there. I do not know.
I was going to say that I think it came, I think I was from a video, I think on 119, where they made that correlation.
It could be.
It was the first time I'd ever heard it. I just, they did such a good job raising the correlation between mm-hmm. the two that it just really, you know, made me really think about it. And, you know, they had a lot more in-depth studies that they did on it.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting.
That's an interesting point. I'll have to look at that because that's an interesting idea. It would make some sense if that's the case.
Well, I think there was some argument about, you know, the fact that how could he bring his, you know, the divorced tribes back into his...
Right.
How could he, you know, because he would be breaking his own...
Once you've given a certificate of divorcement, there is no undoing the certificate of divorcement.
Except for through death.
Right. Yeah, somebody has to die.
Which, you know, was part of the argument for the whole, mm-hmm. you know, Yeshua on the cross part. It was just an added element to that whole significance.
That could be. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I'll look at myself. Any other questions or comments so far?
Messiah refused the sour wine, the vinegar.
And he spit it back out. I think he tasted it, recall. He touched his mouth and he spit it out, I thought. I just don't know. I really would have to research that to find out. It's an interesting idea to look at. Some homework for myself. Any questions or comments? All right. Let's jump into this then. Let's see here. There are lots of topics in this reading. They're broken up in different sections. Some of them seem very related. Some of them completely off the wall. You haven't noticed that? From the census to the God making of the calf to killing everybody, and then to going back to Passover, and then don't boil the kid in the mother's milk. Lots of hodgepodge things thrown together in this story section. Not all of them are closely related, but they do have some similarities as to one of the reasons why they're broken up this way. In the first one, let's discuss the census as it starts out in chapter 30. Verse 11, not the beginning of the chapter. It discusses the census, the terumah, the raised up portion. It says, of course, when you take a census of the children of Israel, this is chapter 30, verse 11, according to numbers, every man shall give the Lord atonement for his soul when counting them, so not be a plague among them when counting them. What's the big deal about counting? What does it matter? Who cares if you're counted?
Why would they have to be atoned for being counted? That's what I forgot to ask you. And why would you die
if you weren't?
If you don't pay when you're counted?
Yeah. Why is it okay for Moses to count them, but not okay for David?
Exactly. What's the big deal? What does God have against counting? Does it really matter if I count the people in this room or not? Am I not allowed to count? Is prevention something special about it? Mostly, the counting has to do with why you're doing it. What's your purpose? There's a difference between counting for your own sake, for your own use, versus counting for God's use. God does not permit a census to be taken for someone's own use. David, of course, a primary example. What was David? Those who remember David's counting, I don't remember the chapter and verse right now, but he was inspired, used the term very loosely, by God himself to count all of Israel. And Joab, David's commander, told him, don't do this. You know it's against the law to count all the people of Israel. And David persisted, I'm going to count them anyway. So David counts them all out. He gets some number, I forgot what it was. And then, at least Nathan, the prophet, comes to David and points out to him, hey, you aren't supposed to count. But you did anyway. So you have choices. Either 3 days of massive plague, 3 months of destruction, or three years or something else. I forgot. The choices David had to choose of which punishment he was going to allow the children of Israel to go through, of the nation. And of course, David said, better off be in the hand of God punishing them than the hand of a foreigner, so he chose the 3 days of a plague. So, massive plagues are sweeping the nation, just whacking people off left and right. They're just dropping dead for 3 days. And David can't stop it. Nobody can do anything about it. This plague is coming through. The end of the third day, this angel of the Lord stops and stands there. It's recorded in the Chronicles. Stops and stands with a sword drawn, just standing there outside Jerusalem, which, of course, is where David's living. Standing outside Jerusalem, just stands there. And David looks up and sees this angel standing there waiting. David runs out, sees where the guy is standing there. He goes to I forgot the gentleman's name who owns the property. He says, hey, I'm going to buy this property right here, right now. I'll pay you whatever you can think of. And he goes, well, I'll just give it to you free. No, pay me whatever it is, name it. He names the price tag, pays an exorbitantly huge price tag for it. Buys the oxen and the utensils the guy was using for his I think it was threshing wheat or wine, I can't remember. Offers a sacrifice right then and there. And the angel's standing there watching him, not entering Jerusalem yet, just standing there watching him. And of course, David finding when he completes the task, the angel sheathes his sword, and the plague's done. And of course, that spot becomes the temple, which where Solomon builds a mass temple where that spot was. The angel stopped there and waited for a long time. But that's a long story, has other reasons of why it's done. What was David's purpose for counting? It doesn't say the tax necessarily, but most likely. Because Solomon implements the taxes that David had counted for. But it is to count it on God's behalf or count it for David's behalf? What does your government and my government, why do we get counted every 10 years? For their own purposes. It's for the government's use. They know who you are, how many there are, and what they're going to do about you. For whatever reason, services, taxes, who cares? And redistribute all the... It's for their own use. Are they counting you on God's behalf? No. They don't care what you think or believe. They want to know if you're a warm body and you live here and how old you are. Yes.
It used to also be for purposes of war.
It is. Yes, it's also for purposes of war too. Because David can raise armies this way, or kings can and governments can. It does have its functional uses. So when kings... Oh, sorry, go ahead. You're heading up.
Too, that Hitler numbered the Jews.
Yes,
and
a number.
You know, man will, I mean, if Hitler could have, he would have annihilated everybody. He wouldn't have stopped. But God has his own boundaries, his mercy, that where he stops himself.
Where he stops. He stops the plague
so
of Hitler.
The motivation is totally different.
It is. There's a purpose. What God's doing when God is counting something, he's, the people in particular, he's trying to count them for his own uses. He has something he has to do for them. For example, in the census taken for here, for Israel, he has done twice. The first one was to count how many firstborn are there? Does that match the number of Levites there are? And how do I redeem the firstborn in this way? He had to get the right numbers coordinated up to make it all match. And if it didn't match up, he had to line them up with this offering that was given later. He has to do it again in the book of Numbers. Numbers, the number for counting. the book of Numbers, to count them again for the same purposes. To divvy up who's responsible for what on serving God. Not responsible for who's building the army. Not responsible for how well you tax someone. Not responsible for any other government service you want to offer. That's not God's function or purpose for counting. That is man's purpose for counting. How many people do we have to rile up? How many people do we have to kill or arrest or build facilities for? That's government service. That's all man's doing. So when you're counting two different groups, two different purposes, sorry, two different people are counting, they're for totally different reasons. Completely unrelated. So that's the big function here. Now in God's case, when he says counting, when he counts, there's redemption required, an atonement, a correction, or a participation for the people. We'll discuss this a little bit. But since there's atonement, it's listed actually three times in this section, in verse 13, 14, and 15, of what's offered up. There's something that has to be offered up. It's obviously half shekel, the sacred shekel. Everyone passed the census, is a portion to the Lord. Aaron passes through again in verse 20, shall give the portion to the Lord. And of course, verse 13, the wealthy should not get increase or the poor less. They will all give a portion to the Lord. What's the purpose of the census then? They give a portion to the Lord. to do something. We're going to discuss this topic for a little while now, for a few minutes, this census topic for a while. Because it means a few things than what's, not that it's not here, it's just it's a little more hidden. I erase this little section because it's important. Now he says the difference between why you're doing it, now you're doing what you're doing, and what does this atonement have to do with anything? So what is this atonement, this half shekel of each person? What's its function? What is it? What do they do with it? Well, that's what its immediate function is. What does God then instruct them to do with it? To build the temple meeting, or the temple with it, right. The tent of meeting or the tabernacle. So you have the tabernacle, I'm going to abbreviate, and the tent of meeting, technically different places, but they are similarly used sometimes. That's its function as far as why this money is going to be used for. So God's okay, allowing to capture them all up, to count them all up, and gather this half shekel, which is used to pay the workmen, pay for supplies, because it takes time, obviously, to build this thing up. So he's used... Oh, tab, I abbreviated, and the tent of meeting, I abbreviated. Oh. Sorry, I didn't spell it all out. Of course, they have to fabricate the gold, and they have to do all the work that's happened in the fabric that's built up. I have some questions for you that you probably know the answers for. We all are very familiar with Messiah and what he's supposed to be and what symbols or basic symbols are. Not to say everything, but certain things. So I want to bring this up. What is the temple in Messiah? What is that? It's from a messianic perspective. What is, in a messianic perspective or Messiah's perspective, from his words or his viewpoint, what is a temple? What is the temple?
It's a house of God.
House of God. House of God. Or, well, write that down. So it's a house of God. What does that house consist of? People. So the house of God, which is God, his house is built of people. What did Messiah say about his body? About his body.
He said his body was given.
Say it louder, anybody?
It's a
sacrifice. It is a
atonement.
It is also a temple. It's all interchangeable items. So we have a sacrifice, a temple, a body, the people. They're all interchangeable things. They're all, symbolically speaking, the same. Symbolically, they're all the same items. So we have the house of God, which consists of people. Oops, I read the wrong 10.
And he's also our high priest.
The high priest, we'll discuss that in a minute, or a little later. The house of God, the people, it's also Messiah's body. Which, of course, obviously is our bodies too. So they're all mixed together. So all this stuff is being built, paid for, from the half shekel gathered from the tabernacle and tent of meeting, the census counting. When Messiah died, what did that do to you and I? What did that do to you and I? What did it make us? What did it take care of for us? Our sin, making us dirty, now clean. So it cleanses us up, making us not dirty anymore. What is atonement? No, atonement is to cover something, to erase. The bought back is a different meaning. Atonement is to cover, to make them which is dirty and cover it or atone for it, to make it clean again. It's cover or atone. It's the Day of Atonement is for covering, head covering. It's to cover or cover over what was dirty, make it clean now. So atonement is to clean it. So in each of these cases, which we have Messiah's body being a death and to cleanse us, making us cover up our sins, as we're familiar with that concept, covering up our sins. So Meshua's body, which died for us, was designed to cover our sins. Well, the house of God, which is built of or among or by or for people. It's a house of God that consists of human beings, you, I, the neighbors, whatever. They're all house of God. So his house of God and Yeshua's body is the same thing made up of people, all requiring one main function, covering up your sins. So to build the house of God, also, to kill Yeshua's body, also, to build the house of people, all require one thing. Atonement. They all require the same thing. You have to have an atoned, cleansed, or covered house, which means you have to have an atoned, cleansed, or covered person, which means an atoned, cleansed, or covered human being, meaning Yeshua. All of God's house, all of the components must be atoned, cleansed, and covered. That's what it all is symbolically supposed to be. So if God's function is to count the people, to gather the stuff, he has to then cover them or cleanse them, meaning atone them. That's their purpose. That's their object. That's their function for this counting. And when each person has to give the exact same amount, no more or less, rich or poor, means the offering is the same. The same atonement, the same person, no matter where your background is. In this scenario, I'm going to erase part of this because I don't have time, I don't have space to write it all up. In this scenario, when we atone for each of these people, God's purpose for the counting, to count, or the census, spell it correctly, his function was to count his people, which means his tabernacle. He's counting his house. He's counting what is his. And he is, at the same time, when he counts it, he can then build it and atone for it all at the same time. That's why the half shekel, the atonement offering, that they are preserved or not dead. The counting of the census requires that result. Once you're counted, if I'm Joe Schmo and I want to be counted, I come by, I'm going to throw my half shekel in. That's my Joe Schmo's half shekel. I am now part of whatever's being counted. I am declaring by doing so, throwing my half shekel is, Joe Schmo is now saying, I am part of God's house. Because that's what shekel is going to be doing. It's building God's house, and I am part of it. I am throwing myself in there. I belong to. So this atonement, this counting census, is to count God's house. The house. When you count the house, you are making sure you, as throwing your half shekel in, you're part of God's house. You're part of it. You are agreeing to throw yourself in. You are agreeing to be part of what God is building. It's going to include you too. To be included, you have to do one thing. You must be atoned for. If you aren't, are you ever allowed inside God's house? No. Are unclean people allowed in God's house? Specifically, he says no. Many times. Even the New Jerusalem went down. Guess what? Who's not allowed in there? All the unclean people, the sexual immoral people and everything else, people who are living the life they want to live, they don't get part of it because they don't get atoned. They're not choosing atonement. They're not choosing to be part of the count. So God's purpose of counting the half shekel is to atone them, to pay for or say, okay, I am agreeing in this count with your half shekel to make you or atone for you. Therefore, you, once you're atoned for, are now in God's house. Yes, Jeff.
Could you address the common thing that's brought up about, you know, you need to go clean yourself up before you come to God?
I was going to, because it has the section here in the tent of meeting with the lavor they build. The lavor, the laver, I pronounce it. It's a big basin of water. Labor, thank you. It has, I grew up as a child going around to say lavor, and I don't know if it's the proper pronunciation or not. Is there a French word? I'm not sure what it is. Anyway, to cleanse. That's the function. You're not allowed inside without your cleansing. Sure, we'll address it now. Might as well. So we have the function as far as how you get included in God's house, what he's building. What Jeff pointed out or brought up was the whole, okay, how do you cleanse yourself with the whole water and make yourself clean before you go into the house of God? You don't go in there when you're dirty. This atonement has to do with how you get included or how you get counted in, how God builds his house and part of his people. It's not a key to enter the front door. It isn't. You're included in the house. It's not a key to enter the front door.
I'm sorry, I'm just kind of
trying to get the concept. No, that's fine. That's fine. It's no different than you belong to a family. You have a home. You have kids, whatever. Do every child in your family, they have a key to your front door? Well, you may or may not, depending on their age. Mine, there's no way. It is not a key to the front door. It is a permission required to get in or go out, to lock the door or not lock it. So in the case of cleansing one's self or make so to get in the front door, it requires certain things from you. There's a responsibility in your own personal home, responsibility of a child. Well, in God's house, there is equally a responsibility among the people to get in the front door. We'll discuss that next. Yes, Jeff.
What I was referring to is the common perception that, you know, you've got to basically clean up your act before you come for God's mercy.
Oh, that's different. Okay.
Well, because one of the things that I often hear when I talk about this kind of thing is like, oh yeah, well, you know, God doesn't want me. I'm not good enough yet.
I'm not good enough.
I'm gonna go clean myself up, and then when I get myself cleaned up, then I'll go seek God.
Yeah, that's okay. My pat answer to that, which happens occasionally, I don't get it too often, but sometimes it do happen, is actually addressed not specifically in this Torah section, but in other sections in the Book of Leviticus, where it talks about the Shabbat. There is one thing you will notice if you study any of God's holy days, from Shabbat to holy days to any every ordinary day. They have certain things you do and don't do. One of the things I want to point out to you on Shabbat, unlike all holy days, the Shabbat has no sin sacrifice. None. Zilch. Zero. Never. You never offer a sin sacrifice for Shabbat. You have sin sacrifice for every other holy day, not Shabbat. Why? It addresses what Jeff just pointed out. It is the reason why. Shabbat, where you learn about God, learn about who He is, be part of His family, as He says in this section of chapter 34, discusses this is a sign forever between me and my people, identifying who belongs to me. It has zilch to do with your actions, meaning your way of life, your sins that you have, that you've built up over the years or days or months, however long it's been. Nothing to do with it at all. When you come before God on Shabbat, specifically, it is regardless of who you are or where you came from. Regardless. It doesn't mean anything. It's junk. No one cares what you did the night before you walked through the door for Shabbat. No one cares. It doesn't matter what your sins are or aren't. Because what is the function of Shabbat? To give you rest. To give you rest. Now rest of not just like your day-to-day work. Rest from all the accumulated junk you've been building up for years, months, days, whatever. All that, it is outside. Don't think about it. Don't dwell on it. You are at peace here. So your background, your history, oh, I'm a drug addict, I've done this, I have 12 wives, I've got whatever. I don't care. That is your business and it's outside that door. Whatever that is, it is junk. This is a day of rest. Rest from it. It is separate. You are separated out. After you're here, after you've learned, not here this building, right? On Shabbat. After you've learned, and you say, okay, now here's my list of what God wanted from me versus where I am. What am I going to do about it? That's where everything else comes in. Yes, Jeff.
Well, do you think that's what the apostles were getting at when in Acts 15 they were talking about, you know, about just basically four things that the new believers from the nations...
Very basic things.
Because, you know, because Shabbat after Shabbat, they're going to hear the Torah preached.
Exactly. In a nutshell, they said the exact same thing. That's what it's for. So whatever your background is meaningless. On Shabbat, it doesn't mean anything. It's just throw it away, move forward, move on. Now, this is not to say that because I attend on Shabbat, therefore I'm allowed in God's Holy of Holies, and be able to be with him and shake hands, say, hey, Dad, sit on his lap, regardless of all the sin that I currently do. No. That's not what it means. Shabbat, entering in or into God's rest and saying, ignore the stuff you've done, is a different thing than you going up and sitting on God's lap and having a chit-chat conversation. He'll kill you when you walk in the door. I'm sorry, but we would all be dead. Because, yeah, just like the mountain. You just get to go. Just because you attend on Shabbat doesn't mean, oh, now all your sins are erased. That doesn't work that way. That takes where all the holidays come in, all the belief in Messiah comes in, the trying to clean up your own life comes in, fixing your actions. That's all that stuff, and that requires a lot before you're allowed to go sit on God's lap. It's a lot of work. That's a different story than being included in God's kingdom, which is what we're doing here with this counting. Being included in his kingdom is not the same thing as being able to sit on his lap. It means included in his kingdom. It means he rules over you. He is your king. Including kingdom means you are under a king. King there. Now, when you have your atonement and we go through what Messiah did and your belief system and you dispose of the junk which you've been accumulating for years, after those work process goes through, which every priest had to go through, every Levite had to go through, every person to go through when they want to go visit with God, there is a process they had to walk through to get there. It's not instantaneous. I'm a sinner today. I believe in God. Now I'm on his lap. It doesn't work quite that way. You actually have to do something. That's where the washing yourself comes in. That's where the cleansing yourself comes in. That's where the action words come in, which is different than Shabbat. Yes, Jeff.
Well, it made me think of being inside the house of God versus, you know, being like, into the inner chambers of the house of God.
Right.
Similar to something that this phrase that always kind of troubled me for a long time, as if someone who's escaping through the flames, whereas that person is just basically, he's inside the door, but he's gone no further.
Yeah, you can't go past the door. Better be a doorkeeper in the house of God for a day or than a thousand, one of the Psalms, I forget what it is, David rattles it off. Yeah, you just made it in the door, and guess what? You stay in the door. You don't get to go any further. That's where the threshold, you want to go further, that requires work. Because you have to walk. You go deeper in the house of God, you got to start walking. Start doing something. Start being something. Start working on your life and trying to correct it. That's where all that stuff comes in. But that's independent of, I'm an awful human being, God has no use for me, I have to clean myself up first. No. You can't clean yourself up on your own. Any one of us can clean yourself on your own. Can you erase your own sins? Good luck. You can stop, but you can't pay for it. Neither can I. No one can. So that's a different story. So somebody has the issues of, I can't even attend God's, I can't go to church every week or anything else. That's a different problem. That's a person who is choosing to say, actually, in my opinion, making an excuse for themselves, trying to not get there. So I hope I answered that kind of question, because I'm going to move on to the next step. Any other comments on that one? All right. I erased my line. What was it? What did I write down? What was the next one? Working for God. Oh, not permitted. Right. On Shabbat. Thank you. Okay, let's move forward. So God had rattled off, all right, hey, these two guys had done lots of good stuff. The Bezalel and what's the other guy's name? I forgot. Thank you. Talented and all this great stuff. That's great. More power to them. I'm not. A little envious, but that's okay. they're good at what they do. However, there's something important to remember. I'm going to erase this section. Just because I'm working for God, does that mean I get to keep working on a Shabbat? No. A Shabbat... Oh, go ahead.
What is considered working for God? I mean, like the priests work on...
Right. That's what we're going to discuss.
Okay.
What does it mean? Because what is classified as working? As Messiah pointed out quite clearly, the priests work on Shabbat every single Shabbat. I mean, name one they don't. That's a problem. They have to kill animals on the weekly days. They also have to do the same thing on Shabbat too. They have to deal with your gripes and your complaints and whining of your life during the week. And guess what happens on Shabbat? They have to deal with your gripes and complaining, you're whining on Shabbat too. When do they have a day off? They have the holy days they have to work, Shabbat they have to work, every day they have to work. Wow. I'm confused. Where, how is it that in this instance, in chapter 31 of Exodus, it clearly points out you're doing all this work, you're a talented person, so you're building God's house, meaning the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and everything else, all the instruments and whatever else you're going to use. God's, I'll put his stuff, because he's a whole bunch more than just a house. His stuff. And even though you're working and building his stuff for him, for the people to use, God's not using it, the people are. You're building God's stuff for the people to use, well, that's a good thing, isn't it? That's great, right? You're helping people come to God, right? That's wonderful. Perfect. What a good job. Kudos to you. So you're building God's stuff. God still says, you better take my day off. So Shabbat is off. We're going to discuss that with Levites commanded to. And I'm bringing this up because it's important. When God built the world, even he took a day off. So he intended to take the day off. It was planned on doing so. So he's building it, he's creating building out. How much better was his building job than this building job? Look around you, okay? His is pretty cool. It actually lives. It does stuff. Ours is kind of stagnant, kind of just hangs out there and looks pretty. There's a huge difference. His is more valuable in every way. But even he said, days off. So with his creation, which is far greater, he still took his Shabbat off. He said for our taking his Shabbat off. How was that reconciled with the Levite work? Yes, Jeff.
Is there a difference between the basic, quote, creation, unquote, of the tabernacle versus the operation of the tabernacle?
Exactly. Next question, which leads me, thank you. When God took his day off, day seven, on day eight, we're assuming Adam and Eve are up there looking around saying, what's all this stuff? Here are the animals, name them all, whatever else he's got to do. Has God taken a Shabbat off since? Has God taken a Shabbat off since creation? Has he ever not answered a prayer? Even though the answer is, has God ever not answered a prayer on a Shabbat or any day of the week? Is there any day of the week he does not answer prayers? No, there isn't. He still answers prayer. Now, Messiah points out that God is the Father who draws you. Is there any day of the week which God will not draw you to him? No. He can draw you to any day of the week. So, there is a huge difference between building and operating. A world of difference. God still answers prayers even on Shabbat and holy days. He still draws people to him even on days or days off. That's how he talks to each one of us. That's how he got here. So he doesn't take the day off from operations. He takes the day off from the building. Get the difference? So when these men were building God's stuff, they're building his stuff. They're not operating. They're not running it. They're building it. Once it's built, now it's the Levites to run it. Levites, you run it all the time. Now you will notice that there are less tasks to do on Shabbat than there are some of the other days of the week for Levites to do. They have a reprieve of some of the workload. Only some. And they also, of course, David implements the rotating cycles. So the priests have their weeks and months off for every year. So they have their chunks of time which they don't have to do anything, go do their own stuff, or just live life. And so they have their times with that stuff too, which David implements many years later. But the operation and building are two different things. Yes.
Number one, Greg and I have been reading Ezekiel in our time.
Oh, okay.
And it specifically has several times where Yahuwah says he will not listen to prayers for certain people. That's number one. And number two, is this where you're going to answer exactly what it means for work for
that's
us?
That's my intention, yes. As far as when God will answer a prayer, if you look at the context of Ezekiel, actually he says it a couple different spots. He doesn't answer the prayer, or doesn't hear the prayers of sinners. That's written in a couple different places, a couple different ways. That isn't the fact that God's not answering prayers at all. He's not answering a particular person's or group of prayer. That's a huge difference. A person who, by the way, which I've said this before, and in case you guys forget, a sinner is not a person who commits a sin. Every human commits a sin. We're humans. We make mistakes. A sinner is a person who lives in their sin, who lives it. It's like, wow, I like women every week. I choose a new one and I go home, do like this, and I brag about it. I'm living my life. That is a person living in their sin. Okay? I can't imagine why, but that's what I want to do. That's living in it. That is a sinner. Okay? There's a difference between that person who says, I tried my best. I made a mistake this week. I did whatever. Imagine, fill in the blank. I will do better. I'm trying to repent, move forward. That is the person who sinned, past tense, and is trying to move forward. They're totally different groups of people. Okay? Yes, Carrie.
I was just thinking as far as, you know, building the temple mm-hmm. Versus operating the temple, the operations are basically the same as getting the ox out of the ditch.
A lot of them are very similar to that function. A lot of them are very similar as far as how they work, because they are necessary things. If you notice the operations for the Shabbat, I don't remember all off the top of my head. I can't remember every single list. But there's, I think it's two lambs. It's two lambs in the morning, two in the evening, or just one each. I forgot. And there's prayers, and of course, there's the incense has to be burnt, and of course, the candles still have to be monitored. There's tasks that have to be done, which are not huge, complex, labor-intensive tasks. Note, the priests also had, during this time, other tasks that God made sure they did have rests on. For example, did they have to build or tear down the tabernacle of meeting or tent of meeting on a Shabbat? Nope. Did everybody have to travel carrying all their workload and carrying their stuff on their shoulders on Shabbat? Nope. So the building of the stuff and assemble and disassembly didn't happen on Shabbats. So God still gave them rest. It's the workload, the operation of it, was not a resting time. Operations still had to be required. Now, let's discuss labor in general. Messiah says, get up your bed and walk. Go do something. Oh, yes, go ahead.
When I was practicing Christianity, they told me that I didn't have to worry about that because I was a caregiver, that I was, it's a mercy job. Merciful job that no matter what, you could work on. Well, at that time, Sunday was the day I would go to church, and sometimes I got called off, and I had to go, but mm-hmm. that's what they would tell me is that, well, that's mercy work. You don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. So,
that is the same reasoning given to paramedics, hospitals, police soldiers. A lot of reasonings given for those circumstances. Now, those reasonings are not creations off the top of somebody's head. They didn't invent it off their head because they felt like it. Those creations have their root in both Solomon and David, as well as Messiah's instructions. Okay, there is some base as what they're talking about. There are details that sometimes get lost in translation, but there is a base there. So, for example, in David and Solomon's time, when the Levite priests were divvied up and they were broken up to their 12 groups of all their sections throughout the year, they were also broken up in rotation cycles too. So every so many months, during when they built the temple, it was every 3 months, I can't remember, 3 months or something, 7 months off, people were allowed to go home and not work on it at all, do their own thing. But they had to serve the rest of the time while they were working. So, and there were also soldiers that were guarding the temple even on Shabbat. They had their swords in their sheaths, had to stand there and guard even on a Saturday. But it's a day of rest. You know, put your bed down, right? Put your sword down. But they had a task to do, guard the temple. It had its uses later on and explains periodically when that guard was needed to do something, in particular the killing of the queen, I forgot her name, Athalia, I think, or whatever her name was. I forgot her name was. Killing the queen, those guards did their job. So they had their function. They had their purpose. Now let's discuss a little bit more about the take of your bed and walk. How does that work? How does that jive with stuff? As well as serving. And where do you draw the line? Where do you say, okay, this service I'm doing, but where is my line drawn? I, Daniel, cannot draw your line for you. That is way beyond my authority. I can give you examples of what people in the Bible have done, but I cannot draw your line, all right, or anybody else's line. So let me erase this real quick. Get a little bit off topic, but that's okay. That's part of it. Athalia, that's her name? Yeah, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm getting your question. So first of all, work. Messiah's task, when he healed the man, and get up your bed and walk, it was a Shabbat night. Messiah specifically chose most of his healings to land on Shabbats. That was his objective. It wasn't a happenstance, oh, look, he's walking. No, he did it on purpose, okay? So work on Shabbat. What is permitted? We know service of God's house is permitted on Shabbat. Levitical priesthood serves God's house. They are operational. They're functional, make the sacrifices and things done. So work on Shabbat. What is considered permitted? Service. What kind of service? Which we're going to talk about. I am up here talking to you. It takes me time to write my own notes down. And luckily, I'm doing my best, you know, some good days, some bad, of serving as whatever God I think wants me to do. It is a service. It's also work. This isn't an easy thing to do. It's not my daily work. I have an engineering job. I do my job during the week. This is still work, though. It's a different kind. It's still work. This is a service work. A service. Now, I'm not saying I'm equivalent to anybody else who offers better services. I'm just saying it's still a service concept. So Shabbat, service. What kind of service are we dealing with? This kind of service, which is why I mentioned before, the word engrave or inscribe is also the word for freedom in Hebrew. The service is freedom. That is your service. Your service is freedom. It means a lot of things. Change colors. Freedom. What is freedom? Freedom from what? What does God want you or I or anybody else? What are the priests? What were they doing? What were they serving? How were they serving people? So the priests had tasks to do. In particular, they had sacrifices to make. So there were offerings. The offerings. Offerings given. What were those offerings? What did they include? Well, lots of things. There were this animal, that animal, this drink offering, the grain offering, the wave sheaf offering, if there was one, the first fruits, lots of different offerings, lots of offerings. They're serving people. They're doing something. Their offerings are serving, but they're serving in a particular way. They're serving in a function, which is beautifully done. The inscribing God's words on those stones, those tablets, which are now dwelled, just sit, hanging out inside the box, or not now, but they were supposed to be hanging out inside the box where he sits, the Ark of the Covenant. I drew up here 2 weeks ago about what that box looked like, and it's actually a person, as far as not by its physical structure, but by the conceptual symbolic parts. There's wood on the inside, gold wrapped around. It's a person. God opens the lid, puts tablets in. Your heart of stone, written tablets, sort of now inside you, inside your box, and God's sitting on you because you're his throne. You're his kingdom. So they're serving, and they're doing one particular way in this service. They're serving you to complete that inscription. Complete. I'm going to abbreviate because I misspelled complete. Complete inscription. That inscription that God wrote in those stones, supposed to be on your heart. What do you do with them? Those Ten Commandments, what do you do with them? You live them, right? They're written in you. You live them the best you can. Good or bad, you do the best you can. If they're being written down inside of you, that means they are inscribed. Is it I? Thank you. They're written. They're written down in you. And the word inscribed in Hebrew is freedom. So inscribed and freedom. So freedom is written in you. Inscribed is written in you. God's words are freedom. God's words are inscribed. The inscription is free. This is the service Levites were doing. They are serving the inscription on Shabbat and every other day of the week. They're serving that, which means for the people, they're serving their freedom. Grant to them freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom from your burdens and your sins. The stuff you're supposed to leave out the door when you walk in. It's that freedom. Get rid of them. Now let's go to where Messiah shows up. What did he serve all those people he healed? He gave them freedom, didn't he? Freedom from all the stuff, their miseries, their stuff they've got built up. He gave them freedom, which means, as a result, if he gives them freedom, that means he gave them the inscription in their hearts to do what? Follow God. Look, that man healed me. What does he have to say? What are the words coming out of his mouth? Meaning, what are the Ten Commandments written down? What are they? Teach me more. I want that type of freedom. That's the freedom that this whole, the Ten Commandments are supposed to have on them as God's own written, scribed hand, his own freedom written out. I mean, but they're laws. How can they be free? Are you kidding? Look what's out there. Look what makes you not free. Every sin, lust, and desire you can think of. Everything else that isn't free, that burdens you heavily, it makes you a slave. Yeah, those laws are free, because those laws, that stuff is junk. I get to throw it away. I do get freedom. So this service, this work on Shabbat, is doing one thing that's permitted. It's a service to facilitate freedom. God's words. Does that make sense? No. So when Messiah told the guy, take up your bed and walk, it proves to him and to all around him, I am free. Because I could never, ever do this. It is beyond my ability normally. I am now free. That's the beauty of it. He proved to the man and everyone around who could see, this man is free. He can do what he couldn't do before. Yes, Jeff.
Makes me think of a couple of things. First off, about service related to freedom and service related to slavery, which is one of those things that you see. And it gets kind of confusing because, you know, Isaiah in the first chapter rails against that. He rails against service.
Right.
And he says, I don't want this service. I don't want,
exactly.
I don't want your festivals.
What are they doing?
All these things because that was coming out of obligation.
Right.
And people were doing
exactly.
It because they were supposed to do it, but it was not coming out of their freedom or trying to make anybody else
free. It wasn't producing freedom. It was producing burdens.
Yeah, I mean, as Isaiah goes on, it's talking more about enslaving the people
yes.
because of what they were doing.
Exactly.
And the second thing is that the apostle Yaakov or James says, you know, when I look into the perfect law of liberty, and one of those, a lot of people wonder what under the law of liberty is about, and that is supposed to be it's supposed to be setting you free from things,
right.
Not bringing
exactly.
you into enslavement.
And what are we enslaved to? As he points out in Isaiah, that is true, absolutely true. The Levitical priesthood, and not just rail against them, people in general do this. When you have this, I use the term loosely, authority over others, we tend to wield it, don't we? I can make you do this, so I can dance, little boy, dance, kind of thing. We're human. We do this. So when you are working on Shabbat and you are not fulfilling a freedom, but as Isaiah points out, and Jeff pointed out too, you are fulfilling an enslavement, that is the opposite of God's work. You're now working for the adversary, because the opposite of God is an adversary, which is the Hebrew word for hasatan. You are now a Satan worker, because you are building an adversary task. You are creating enslavement. That is the opposite of freedom. You're not engraving on people's hearts anymore, are you? You're engraving them on their hands or tasks. Go do this, go do that. There's a huge difference. The engravement on those stones was supposed to be your heart of stone. We've read that in the New Testament many times. A heart of stone, if you would have a heart of stone, you would have a heart of flesh, a soft one, who is always written there. So those Ten Commandments get written in that stone, which is supposed to go inside the box, which is supposed to be you. It's supposed to instill a sense of freedom in you from all the stuff that you've done, or haven't done, or wanted to do, or think about doing. All the stuff out there. That's the freedom you're supposed to be free of. Not a, okay, now I'm free of that stuff. Now here's my load of work I have to do to please the person up there that says I have to go do this. I have to go do that. I have to do this. I have to do that. I have to offer this. I have to offer this. The next piece. The next. Now you've changed from freedom out of my sins to enslavement of my taskmaster, who was at the time political priesthood. The Pharisees were a key example, so were the Sadducees of Messiah's time, as far as the enslavement of the people. They went from freedom full circle back to a deeper enslavement. But they slapped God's name on it. He doesn't take kindly to that. So that was a different story, a more extreme level of what happened. Yes?
And I don't mean this rudely to Jews, but that's why I don't like to hear about their stuff, because they distort the truth with all this extra garbaggio that you have to do
to
just listen to the word. Yeah. So a lot of people quote Jewish stuff, and I'm like, I really don't want to hear that. It's not in the scriptures, and I don't mean it rudely.
Right, right.
It's just, I want to learn this first before I even know about the other stuff they do.
Mm-hmm. I get that. I understand your perspective. Play on English word. Mud, the word for mud. Any questions so far on this section of what work means and what its function? Now, when you're going back to your example, which you signed up, Deanne, regarding the serving of a person who's ill or needs help or whatever, there's nothing evil about serving someone who needs help. That's not a problem. So if someone needs help and you serve them, you did a good thing. Nothing wrong with that. What are you serving them? How are you serving them? If you're facilitating a freedom, that's great. I'm not arguing that you should, not on Shabbat. My point is that serving of freedom is its function. When you are not serving in freedom, you're not doing it. For example, the ox in the ditch. You're freeing the ox. People have used the example saying, well, I have to work this day because my boss will fire me. You're no longer serving in freedom. You're serving your boss. That is not an ox in a ditch. That's you serving your boss. You are now enslaved to your boss. That's the opposite of freedom. Yeah, there's a difference between what we are serving. And I cannot draw your line for you. You have to do it. Greg, could you hand up?
I think what you're talking about is the difference between serving and laboring.
It is. It is. It is a big difference. That is the dominant change. Yes.
On Shabbat before we come here, that's okay.
I would probably say yes, because the dog really needs to go to the bathroom.
Feeding them is okay.
Yeah.
But he and I have had discussions on whether or not to make the bed. So we don't.
I don't make my bed either. My wife does.
My understanding of work was any type of work, but then now I'm understanding maybe it may not be.
It's not affecting
anybody.
I can't draw your line for you. That's you. But the service that is considered acceptable in God's eyes on Shabbat is a service to freedom. Whatever you define as freedom, that's for you and him, not me. Yeah, I don't want to hear about it. It doesn't have a soul, so I'm not going to say what it doesn't have.
Ultimately, those sacrifices point to Messiah. Everything that they're doing, they are a provision of life for the people of God. And Messiah is Lord of the Sabbath.
And that's what each of these instances are supposed to be. They aren't, or freedom of burdens in particular. It can be death is dominant, but burdens, for example, the person who is lame on their foot or whatever, that gets healed, or blind man, whatever, he's not dead, but it's a great burden that he sucks away a huge part of his life, or her life. That life is taken away, not by actual execution, but rather by living. The living was reduced because of this burden. So now the burden's gone, the living is now full. Life is in fullness of life, which is the point of it. That's how you're doing freedom. So when you're serving somebody who's ill, and they get better, hopefully, guess what? You're relieving their burdens that are taking away their life. That's a good thing. That's a beneficial thing. I won't argue the walking dog or the bed thing. That's your decision. But we all have our own to make. There's other parts of this. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Well, you know, being new to Sabbath, you know, that's always something that's, you know, we try to live correctly and properly and try to do what we feel is right or what the Lord would look at as right. You look at passages like in Mark where he talks about, you know, where Jesus says, you know, if you're doing what's good on the Sabbath, then, you know, it's okay.
Right.
So you think about, and we live in a monetary system. So for us to drive here is an hour and 40 minutes.
It's a long drive.
If we didn't on prep day fill our gas tank,
you would make it.
We have to get gas.
Right.
Are we to go on our way home? You know, do we wait till the sun goes down before we stop in to get something to eat because somebody's going to be waiting on us? You know, these are all issues that we deal with constantly, especially with, you know, coming from a Christian Bible church. All of our friends are Christians, and they look at me and how they judge me on how I keep my Sabbath. And as we try to just do it, you know, mind you, you know, being, you know, like, the fact that, you know, we do live in a monetary world, there's sometimes that these things can't be helped. But on the other hand, you know, when you're talking about work, I mean, if a tree falls on my neighbor's house and needs help putting a tarp over it because it's raining, I'm
help
there.
The guy.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. But on the other hand, you know, as people that work for me, it's like certain things just have to seem to get done. But I tell them, you know, no, it's Sabbath, and for you to work, you work for me, so you need to take that day off also.
That's as an employer,
sometimes
yeah.
Sometimes they went and done things that they knew needed to be done, but it wasn't I that was telling them, you know,
that's,
I told them.
That you're absolved. If you say, hey, I am not hiring you to do the work this day, on this day, go do your own thing, your day off, it's your business. If that person says, I'm going to ignore you, my employer, and go do it anyway, that is their freedom of choice. That is beyond your control in that way.
So the question is that I was getting to, is I was going to draw, you know, I mean, it's like, if the water line breaks in our house and our house is flooding, we can shut the water off.
Yeah.
But we still need to call a plumber on Saturday if it's Saturday. You know, I mean, can we wait till Sunday? Is it, you know what I mean? I mean, how do you...
Those are decisions,
how do you really
yeah.
look into those things? And,
those, mean, yeah.
And then living in a life of, you know, where we know, you know, it's like, I mean, we can repent. You know what I mean? It's like, it's
I know. It's not
hard.
Easy. It's hard. A lot
it truly
of,
is a work.
Yeah, the individual tasks, it is, the individual tasks that each of us make our decisions on are not always easy ones. A few years ago, my roof blew off. It was coiled up and wrapped up with a little tin can. I live in a mobile home. A wrapped tin can, and it was laying on my neighbor's fence. And it blew off on a Friday night. And so my job, Saturday morning, I had to cut that roof up to pieces and send it to a recycler. Because if I didn't, my neighbor's fence would fall down and the rest of the roof was going to fall into my neighbor's house. That's very expensive. And he didn't have homeowner insurance. I did. And guess what? Who's going to pay for it? Yeah, I had my father-in-law and myself. We worked there all day on Saturday, and with little tin snips, cut away the aluminum roof. It took all day. And by like 4 o'clock the day, I was finally done. That was a decision I had to make. It's not an easy one. It's one I had to make. I could have left it and said, okay, God, I hope the rope holds. I had a rope tied and wrapped around it, trying to hold it to attach to my house so it wouldn't fall all the way. I didn't know if it would hold or not, but it was a decision I had to make. It wasn't an easy one. I said, okay, I got to do something. And I could wait for another day and hope all goes well. And maybe it would have. I don't know. But a decision I chose. So I chose to work on it. And that's what I did. Now, granted, did I get paid for it? Of course not. I wouldn't accept a dime for that. Did I pay anybody to work for me? No way. It was all free. The recycle people don't charge you, but they have to station, they're working there to station the recycle joint. But they didn't charge me because it was recycled metal. But either way, it's still a work decision that has to be made. Sometimes emergencies happen. You have to decide at that moment what you're going to do. I can't make the decision for you, and God does. Now, there are lots of reasons why my roof blew off, and I've figured out a whole bunch of them as to what God was teaching me, and he taught me something very important lesson. And I learned that, and I won't forget it again. Something about a different issue. But and that's where I look at where if something happens in such a way that I was unable to prepare for it, then, okay, God, what are you teaching me? If something happens in such a way that I chose not to prepare for it, okay, God, what are you teaching me? There's two different lessons and two different ways which I got to figure out what's going on. Sometimes the lesson I just need to learn, sometimes the lesson of my own personal neglect. Both of them have the issues. I mean, for example, your gas issue today, which you brought up. My truck is almost out of gasoline right now. Well, I drove down here. Well, I may or may not make it back. It's in Healdsburg, right? Not that far. But if I leave late enough, well, then the gas station will go buy gas on the way. It's a decision I've got to make, and we'll decide. I'm not going to worry about it. It just happens to be. I hadn't planned on driving down. My wife had a full gas van, but I didn't decide to take that one today because I was already loaded with the truck. It's just choices that we make and build up. All right, what lessons do we learn from these choices? And what can we do about them? If you always make the same bad choice, am I learning anything? No. If I learn from the choices I've made and see and look back and say, okay, we are humans. We are designed to be storytellers and story hearers. That's our built-in God-given blessing, like animals. We're designed to look back and see our own personal history and learn from it. That's how we do things. That's how we remember stuff, is our own histories. So if we aren't learning anything, it's a wasted lesson. And God's going to say, here's the repeat button again. He said, here's the repeat button again. He likes the repeat button.
I hate those.
He's good at it. Yes, Deanne.
It reminds me of when Yeshua, like you said, he was doing a lot of healing on the Sabbath. And the people are like, hey, you can't do that. And he goes, hey, if an ox falls into a hole, are you not going to help?
Pull
pick them up and get them out of there.
Right.
And us learning and growing, I mean, we're newbies. We're learning. I put gas in my car early in the day. I can't tell you how many times I drove here on almost Eagle.
Almost
please,
nothing.
Lord, yeah. Don't break down, you know.
It's happened. It happens.
And there is time where I had to get gas on a Shabbat because yep. I was new and I'm learning. And I remember Richard saying, God knows where your heart is. Because I feel guilty. I'm like, gosh, I broke Shabbat. I went and bought a bunch of gas.
Right.
You know, but I wanted to go. And he says, just pray and repent and just try to work your own schedule.
Exactly.
Out.
Work.
It takes time.
It takes work.
It takes time to learn all this stuff and to not forget.
Right.
You know.
It's a way of living. It's a way of life. Yes, sure.
On this issue, because I've had these situations. So my personal experience is we come into habit of every Thursday night we fill up.
Yeah, it happens.
Just out of?
Yeah, out of habit.
Out of habit.
It's Yeah, it's a part of, when you learn what works, what doesn't work, that's how we learn. If somebody came in the door and said, hey, I know nothing but shop Shabbat, but I already do everything there is, that's very impressive. Because it's really a lot. Means that they've already learned all the lessons, and they're just learning about Shabbat now, but they already know the lessons of Shabbat. That's a backwards person. People come in knowing nothing, not here, I mean just in general, coming to God's ways, knowing nothing and learning. Well, there's a whole list of things. And while I do all this stuff, for example, for years and years and years, my wife and I, we always cooked breakfast on Saturday mornings because it was the only time we cooked breakfast together. It was fun, whatever. Great, let's cook breakfast. But it was always nagging, says God, to do not kindle a flame on Shabbat. Do not prepare your food on Shabbat. Okay? But we always do this. God understands. Yeah, you're right. For years, and then finally, after that nagging thing got nagging over and over and over again, I said, well, how would I do it otherwise? And then lights turned on. Realize, oh, we can actually cook the night before. You can actually warm things up and not cook them if you leave a candle overnight going on your stovetop. Or if you have a stovetop that has a pilot light, that's great too. It's not that hard. When we realize it wasn't that hard, we realize, okay, now we know it's not that difficult for us to not do this. It's really actually quite simple. It's a matter of preparing. We learned something. And thus, we then move forward, because now with our new learning. It's all about learning. We all are in the same boat. In different parts of the boat, some are in the side, right, or what, the port and the starboard, whatever. Fore and the aft, the starboard and port. So we're in different parts of the boat, but we all are learning how the boat runs. It's not easy. And we learn. Yes, Carrie.
Well, and sometimes we have to learn a lesson. God uses it to show somebody else. My first year in Torah, we had a couple of friends that were asking us a bunch of questions because they were like, what the heck are you guys doing? Because we were in the same Sunday church together. And the girls and I went to go stay with them for a weekend, and I worked full-time at the time, and there was just, you know, we were new. So I drove, and they lived down in Manteca. So I drove all of this way, and I didn't have enough gas. And we got, like, within a half hour of their house, and my light had been on already for miles. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And so I just prayed, and somebody, let's see, I think I talked to one of them and said, you know, I'm going to have to stop for gas. And they were like, okay. And I got to the gas station, and I walked into the gas station, and I had money in my hand, and it was Friday night after dark. And I'm standing in there and standing in line, and I couldn't do it. And I walked back out and got in my car, and we started driving, and I just prayed. I said, God, please just get us to our house. I couldn't do it. Well, we stayed with them that weekend. And afterwards, I realized if I had bought gas, they asked me questions the entire weekend. And here I was, it was my first year, so there's a whole bunch of information I didn't have. But I did have the testimony of God got me to your house, even though I didn't know enough to prepare. But then a few years later, on a Sabbath, I drove to a cousin's wedding that was far away, and I didn't prepare that time. And that time, there was nobody to know the difference or anything. And it was like, all right, God, you got me again.
You got me again.
So it was kind of like, you know, I had the same lesson even a couple of years later, but there was a difference. Like that time, there was no excuse. I had to buy the gas, and there was no miracle. But the first time, it was a testimony to somebody else who God was kind of tapping on their shoulder. So he got me there on a miracle, and it was a testimony to them. So it's just kind of interesting.
Lessons we learn. They're good lessons. I didn't get to half what I was going to cover today, but I'm out of time. any questions? I'm sure there's probably lots of them. I didn't get to all your questions you guys have brought up, but at least some of them. I didn't talk about the golden calf or really much anything. Thank you for your time. It's not an easy task to discover our own boundaries and limits. We have to learn what they are. Each person has their own. And, which I did up here, which I'll put like my one little liner on here, is making your own gods. Each and every one of us do this all the time. Anytime I say, or you say, or anybody else says, I'm doing this, even though God really didn't want me to do it this way, I'm doing this because blah, 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 blah. I have now made my own God. Because I am claiming to follow one God written down here in this book. It is like making yourself a God, or your own definition. You've redefined him. I've redefined him. The example I gave before, the cooking on Shabbat and lighting candles, who cares, right? I redefined the God that I was worshiping when I do that. Because I claim, openly, verbally, to follow the God of the Bible as best I can. But I also claimed, well, this one line that God says don't do, it's okay. I have now redefined what the God of the Bible says. But I slapped his name on it. I'm still claiming to follow him, but I'm disregarding part of this. So I'm remaking him. I'm remolding him in my own image. My own vision of him. Every one of us do it. We try not to. We all do. We're all guilty of it. It's not easy. So, although the people made their own God and God was mad at them and Aaron helped them, I also have to remember that God helped me too. And I've made my own gods many times. Lots and lots and lots of times. I've made my own, and I've sometimes, mostly, I hope, figured it out and threw it to the dirt. And retried again. We all remake our gods. The point is, he doesn't want that because we're slapping his name on it. It's a big deal. So when we're trying to live the life that he told us to live and say, yes, we're following his life, and we tell other people, we're following life, but ignore this part of mine that you're not supposed to look at, we have rebuilt a new idol, and we've made yet another god. Yes?
I have a picture in my phone that reminds me. It goes, reminder, idolatry is any value, any idea, any relationship, and anything that challenges the exclusive top priority that belongs to Yahuwah.
That's a great definition. So remember that. Hopefully don't forget it. Yes, Jeff.
Thank you for bringing us to our senses.
Thank you. You were waiting for that, weren't you? Yeah, you were. Thank you for your time. Have a good rest of your Shabbat.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.